Chapter 2. Once an Inquisitor? The green shine of the Dungeon Lord's eyes died slowly. He lay in a pool of his own blood, surrounded by the broken corpses of his minions, his back against his seat, the stone surface of which had fractured under the might of the hero's offensive spells. The man that had so proudly stood against the magical onslaught was now but a human-shaped lump, nothing remaining of the dignity with which he had conducted himself until his messy end. Around the seat, his dungeon walls and ceilings had melted somewhat. A few hours more and the entire construction would disappear altogether. Gallio found the knowledge fitting, like a moral added at the end of a children's tale. Yet he could feel his throat clenching while he climbed the steps of the seat room toward the fallen figure.
"It can't be,"
Gallio thought when he was in front of the fallen dungeon lord.
"It can't be him."
He almost turned back. But he was an inquisitor, and inquisitors stared at the light of truth, even if it blinded them. So he reached for the hood and pulled it back just as the light abandoned the dungeon lord's eyes. Gallio stared at the face of the dead man, and kept staring, his face a mask that could have been set in stone. His companion reached his side atop the raised dais. She scowled at the corpse.
"So it isn't him?"
"No,"
agreed Gallio.
"Not this time, at least."
This dungeon lord was someone he had never seen before, a Lotian called Uraz. The man had smuggled himself into Staravos to face the heroes, hoping to find his destiny. He had found it, just not the one he'd expected. A part of Gallio was relieved. What would he have done if the dead had been Edward Wright instead of the stranger? True, at least it meant that the otherworldly dungeon lord was still alive, which meant that so were Gallio's people. It also meant that Gallio and Wright could still stumble into each other. If that happened, the Inquisitor would be forced to break an oath to fulfill his duty to the light. But in doing so, he'd condemn himself. Whatever he did, he could not win.
"Good,"
said Alvedra, still glaring hatefully at the dead dungeon lord. She knelt next to the corpse while drawing an enchanted silver dagger, which she used to sever the corpse's head from its body. It was standard inquisitorial procedure. One could never be too careful with Murmur's favorites. And Gallio nodded. She had learned well, and not a single movement of hers was wasted. Some expert hacks, and the deed was done. She kept the head, grabbing it by the ash-covered hair.
"Any news about our mutual friend?"
he asked her in a whisper, making sure the other members of the militant church inspecting the seat room weren't listening. The heroes were getting close to Undercity, some groups already prowling the countryside. If Edward Wright hadn't yet escaped from Staravos, it was but a question of time before the heroes reached him and he shared the fate of all other dungeon lords before him. Alvedra shook her head while wiping the blood from the dagger with the corpse's cloak.
"No. I've put out as many feelers as I dare to without alerting him. But other than the surge of necromantic energy in Hoya Forest last winter, there's been no clue. Not that the locals care."
Her upper lip stiffened.
"Most of my contacts write about Undercity's officers trying to put down a new smuggling group. Seems like the nobility is more concerned with their purses than the sanctity of their souls. I bet they'll change their tune when retribution comes, but by then it'll be too late."
Alvedra spoke with the zealous intensity of the recently converted. Usually, they mellowed out with time, but she'd need her passion to steel herself for the trials that awaited the expedition.
"Maybe it's a good sign," Gallio thought, "if Wright is keeping his head down. Or better yet, he's gone altogether. There's a chance the heroes may pass him by."
And yet... Gallio and Alvedra walked down the steps of the dais, their red capes fluttering with the small breeze that came from the cracks in the dungeon. A small entourage of servants, men-at-arms, and clerks waited for them at the bottom.
"The dungeon lord is dead,"
Alvedra announced, releasing the severed head from her grip and letting it roll away.
"You may approach."
"My gratitude, Eminence,"
said Master Enric. The grizzled, militant church veteran went past the Inquisitors and climbed the steps using a silver-tipped cane to keep his balance, his famous metal wand hanging from the strap of his belt and swaying with each step. A pair of servants followed him, carrying the surgeon's tools that Enric would use to extract the dungeon lord's heart. The so-called mantle. While Enric set to his grim task, Gallio met with the other Inquisitors. Even with the dungeon lord dead, there was still work to be done. Survivors that had slipped the heroes, supply caches yet hidden in the wilderness that an enterprising minion might use to restart the holds of its former master, and treasure chambers waiting past the seat room, well guarded and loaded with lethal traps. Gallio was the senior inquisitor present, so he was in charge, which meant that if anything went wrong past this point, the fault would fall on him. Besides, there were still a few higher-ups who hadn't liked his return, and they were even now keeping an eye on him, eager to pounce at the slightest mistake. It didn't worry him. Let the old whiners play their games of favorites and politics. He was here because his pledge to Alita demanded it. Nothing more, nothing less.
"There aren't as many Batblin corpses as we expected from the scout reports," he told one sturdy inquisitor named Oak.
Oak was prideful and tall, and lacked an ounce of common sense in that thick head of his. In short, he was young, just like Alvedra, just like Gallio had once been.
"Send rangers along with the militants to reinforce the perimeter. If the Batblins ran away before the battle, there'll be tracks all over the place. The critters aren't known for their discipline, especially when scared to death."
Inquisitor Oak nodded.
"Yes, Eminence," he said.
Gallio nodded and turned to leave. As he did so, Gallio shifted his gaze up toward the shadowy arcs of the ceiling, which were covered in webs and dust. For the briefest instant, he could swear he saw something small and hairy shift near a corner. A rat, maybe? He was about to say something about it when a servant entered the chamber in a rush, his white tunic scraping its hem against the dirty cobblestone floor.
"Eminence Gallio,"
the servant called.
"Cleric Zeki sent for you. He's searching for survivors under the dungeon, and our group located a hidden catacomb. Cleric Zeki says you should come at once. The dungeon lord's vampire survived the fight. The creature is locked in its own coffin, Eminence. Its fate is in your hands."
Chapter 3. Back to the Haunt. The forest gave way to the Haunt's holdings long before they reached the dungeon itself. The first sign of civilization hidden among the forest was a pair of scrambler towers framing the entrance to Haunt-controlled territory. The towers were octagonal stone pylons with a series of rune engravings covering every side and a spherical railway of brass magical systems crowning its top. Illusion enchantments disguised the scramblers as a pair of decrepit trees with skeleton-thin branches, and a complex mesh of magical traps loaded with mind compulsions were always on standby. If triggered, they launched an area-of-effect series of minor orders meant to cause any uninvited guests to go about their business elsewhere, and make them believe it had been their idea. The brass sphere at the top was the most important part of the tower, and a perceptive eye could see a faint shimmer on the surrounding air, the telltale clue of heavy magical activity. The sphere was a complex counterspell system focused on neutralizing divination attempts. It hid the haunt from most kinds of scrying, masking the magical emanations of the dungeon's ley lines. When Ed had bought the dungeon upgrade, Scrambler Tower, the fully functional loadout had manifested itself in his mind, ready for use whenever he had the resources to build them. He could have left it at that, but curiosity had gotten the better of him, and with Levy's help, he had studied the inner workings of the scramblers. The anti-divination sphere was so complex that Levy hadn't been able to even fathom how it worked. Apparently there was unholy magic involved. But the other parts turned out to be simple. The haunt's ley lines powered the whole contraption. They only worked if set directly over one. The traps reloaded their spells this way, and the trigger mechanism was an alarm spell enchanted with permanency. A secondary, permanent alarm would trigger a message spell to warn Ed if someone disbelieved the scrambler's disguise.
or pierced its anti-divination field. Ed would have loved to have a chat with the person or entity who had designed the scramblers and trade ideas. If he focused on their schematics, he could edit them with his own alterations. But for the time being, he lacked the expertise to try.
"Someday, I'll know your secrets," he thought,
throwing the scramblers one last lustful glance as his group left them behind.
"Switch the anti-divination field for one that locates stuff. Figure out a way to translate that data as coordinates and feed them to a fireball trap with an aiming mechanism. And we'll have automatic fireball turrets everywhere we want."
He needed to learn magical theory. So far, he had seen and used exclusively pre-made spells, but as soon as he figured out the source code needed to create those spells in the first place, well, he was a software designer. Ivalis would soon learn the sheer destructive power of databases and select star from spell functions.
"You're chuckling to yourself again,"
Alder warned him as they rode.
"Oh, sorry."
"You should be,"
Levy said.
"Your evil laughter needs a lot more practice before it befits a dungeon lord of my status." "Don't you mean his status?"
Kes asked, lifting an eyebrow. Levy threw her hair back.
"I'm the haunt's head researcher. That's a status symbol in itself. For the haunt, mind you."
They found the next sign of civilization about an hour after passing through the scramblers. A group of four kids of varying ages lay under a tree, enjoying its shade while they ate raisin-like berries gathered from nearby bushes. The kids called to Ed and the others as they passed. Alder waved back at them.
"Their parents will be pissed when they catch them slacking off,"
Kes said with a grin after the kids were out of sight.
"It's a nice day," Ed said. "It'd be a waste if nobody got to enjoy it."
In any other circumstance, a group of kids playing deep in Staravosi woods would have been suicidal, but the haunt's holdings were patrolled by horned spiders and batblins, and few critters dared venture into a dungeon lord's lands, unless they intended to join him. Ed threw a glance at a lone boulder near the grass road they were following. To a stranger, it was solid rock, but to Ed, it was hollow and had a wooden door. Several feet away, a small trail of violet vapor rose from a fist-sized hole in the ground and dispersed itself in the air. The rock was the entrance to a small underground farm carved by Ed's drones. The kids' parents were probably inside. Ed activated his evil eye and confirmed that no alarms had been triggered within, working the fields. They were growing gray puffball, which was a mushroom-shaped tuber about the size of a batblin and native to the Netherworld, so they could grow underground. It tasted like a watery potato, but it was nutritious, and you could grind it into coarse flour to make a calorie-rich bread that lasted a while in storage. Crops native of the Netherworld had quickly become staples of the haunt's diet. Most of them fed on dark emanations the way a normal plant fed on sunlight. The problem was that Netherworld plants poisoned the soil and made it unsuitable for growing a normal plant for centuries, unless a powerful cleric intervened and cleansed it. Growing the crops underground solved that problem, but there was still the issue of the gas. Ed studied the vent that allowed the violet vapor to exit the underground farm. All the Netherworld plants exuded that vapor. It wasn't explosive, nor was it poisonous, and it had no visible side effects. It smelled like taro tea. Andrina, the haunt's herbalist, thought it was the stuff the Netherworld's atmosphere was made of, and Ed was willing to bet his non-skeletal hand that ignoring that detail would bite him in the ass eventually. So all farmers, much to their annoyance, had to subject themselves to monthly health checks, just in case anything went sideways. Not that anything had in the few months since Ed had built the farms. At first, Ed had intended to have drones tend to the crops, but drones were dangerously incompetent with most tasks not related to a dungeon's creation and maintenance. Although Ed sometimes wondered how much of that incompetence was feigned out of laziness. They were very skilled at sculpting rock, for example. That very week, a drone had carved a statue showing the process of horned spider reproduction in extravagant detail. Horned spider reproduction was best described not at all. Unwilling to let the statue terrify everyone in the seat room, he had sent it to terrify everyone in the prison instead. Since he couldn't use drones, he had gone to the villagers for help. Beforehand, he'd racked his brain for incentives to get them on his side. Extra coin? Better housing? Free booze? The reaction of the first former farmers he'd approached had been among his biggest culture shocks since his arrival at Ivalis. "You mean we get to have our own land?" the couple had asked. "And you're only asking for a tenth of the crop in return?"
"Huh?"
Ed had suddenly realized that his whole perspective on feudal-like social contracts was probably wrong. All their lives, the farmers of Barova had owed allegiance to Galtia, the capital of Starevos and where the headquarters of the local branch of the militant church was located. The tax collector would come right after harvest season was over and take half the crops. No farmers ever owned the land they worked, and after their death, their sons could consider themselves lucky if the farm wasn't reassigned to somebody the local authorities liked better. After paying the tax, the leftover crops were used to feed the farmers and their families until the next harvest. Whatever remained of that, which wasn't much, was sold to buy whatever they couldn't make themselves, such as shoes, a donkey, or buttons to repair a tattered vest.
"I mean, it's underground," Ed had warned them.
"Have you ever had to chase down a pack of scared goats after the fence breaks in the middle of a Starevosi storm?" they had retorted, perhaps with more curtsies and some "my lord" sprinkled here and there, but that had been the gist of it. Not only had most of the Haunt's villagers volunteered to tend the underground farms, they had considered it an incredible gift. In this world, everyone, from a lowly peasant to the mightiest king and all his armies, depended on a bountiful harvest to survive. Ed still wasn't sure what to make of the realization, but he had redoubled his efforts to make sure the Haunt was self-sufficient. The only things stopping him from covering the entire forest with underground farms were that the sheer space each farm required a lot of drones and a lot of time to dig. And he couldn't spare either. And that not all ground was suitable for digging, even with his mantle's magic strengthening the caves against quakes.
"The plants exhale this mysterious gas," he had told the farmers. "Seems to be safe. But you know how those things go."
"A pack of werewolves ate my cousin and his entire family. The gas smells better than I do. We'll take our chances." In the end, they had come to an agreement. One adult member of the family would become a minion of Ed. It was a necessity to ensure that they wouldn't run away, and it also allowed Ed to make sure they were safe. If the Haunt ever fell, and the Inquisition purged its minions, the non-pacted adult was to run away with the kids and hide in the nearest village. It wasn't a pretty prospect, but it was life, and it was better than the alternative. Those words were quickly becoming a staple in Ed's inner monologue. After leaving the farms behind, the group stopped in a grove to rest and let the hell chickens cool down. Ed summoned a group of drones to gather branches, and Cass started a quick fire using flint. She always traveled with it, along with a battered iron skillet she refused to give up. They ate hell chicken sandwiches made with puffball bread and thick slices of cheese, and drank warm mead.
"You know, last summer we almost got killed by a mob of batblins,"
Levy said, patting her belly after she finished.
"Now those critters do the fighting for us. If you ignore the militant church and their heroes, I'd say we're doing great."
"Me too," said Alder. "I wish life could always be this easy."
He sighed.
"Beer and food, friends, an army of horned spiders, all the simple pleasures. Then again, a few months of that and I'd run out of things to chronicle."
Kess straightened and threw fistfuls of dirt at the fire.
"I aspire to live a life that would give a bard nothing to talk about."
She winked at Alder, then tossed a chunk of hell chicken breast to her mount, Neckbreaker, who caught it in the air and devoured it whole. The group crested a rocky cliff that was too steep for a normal horse, but that the hell chickens climbed with ease, their razor-sharp talons digging into the ground like it was Rollum's flesh. The Haunts mainland was located inside a depression deep with vegetation at the outskirts of a mountain range that extended all the way up the Sturevos coast and flanked Undercity on its other end. When Ed had first arrived in Ivalis, this section of Hoya had been growing untamed and was rich with predators. Nowadays, the predators were of a different nature. Vast, growing circles of tree stumps broke the green evenness of the forest, with crude lumberyards slowly growing next to them like ticks getting fat off their prey. Gravel roads snaked through the terrain in all directions, getting swallowed in the distance. Faint smoke trails rose up to the sky. The way to the dungeon led Ed and the others past the three growing Batblin encampments, each built next to the other like orphans huddling together for warmth. They were protected by rough and shoddy palisades with only a few dozen sheds surrounding a bonfire, and dozens of Batblins racing around, hauling materials, food, and weapons. From a distance, it was impossible to tell if they were playing, or working, or fighting each other. Ed suspected that they were putting on an air of business because their scouts had seen him approach. Two of the encampments were fully enclosed by the wooden walls, with the third still being constructed. Ed's drones were working on the last third of the walls, dancing over cut logs piled in pyramids next to the construction site. The imp-like creatures weren't happy working with wood, but at least they were competent. Enough. Their purple and pink tunics swayed with the evening breeze, and the crackle of the bonfire behind them gave the tunic's engraved laser shark an almost lifelike imitation of a swim. While Ed watched, purple tendrils of magic manifested around the drones and, directed by their dancing, ate a few of the logs before transforming them into stakes and ropes that snaked in the air and built themselves into the palisade.
"I swear that every time I look away, the Batblins double their damn numbers,"
Levy said, covering her eyes with her hand to glance up at the smoke rising from a dozen different bonfires.
"Soon enough, they'll outnumber everyone but the spiders."
Ed scratched his chin. It was true that the third encampment hadn't been there the night before. It wasn't even connected to the tunnel network yet.
"Seems like Kleck and Tulip are doing great at their recruiting gig. How many clouds can the forest support?"
He knew that Batblin meat was, had been, an integral part of a horned spider's diet. The number of spiders in the forest suggested an equivalent number of prey, which meant there were more Batblins hiding in the forest than one may think at first glance. Nowadays, Kleck and his riders spent whole nights without returning to the hunt, but they weren't close to finished finding all the clouds out there.
"I think they're growing their numbers the old-fashioned way,"
Alder pointed out. A pair of startled Batblins scurried off inside the bushes when they saw the Hell Chickens approach.
"It's because no one is hunting them inside our domains,"
Kes said.
"Batblin's main survival strategy is to outbreed their predators. Wetlands. In a couple of years, we may have a problem on our hands. Netherworld crops or not. There's only so many creatures the land can support."
"That has an easy solution,"
Levy said.
"We'll just eat the Batblins. There are enough of them to feed us."
She snickered at the idea. But it was obvious she didn't mean it. Most of her research assistants inside the dungeon were Batblins, and Kleck was her regular sparring partner. Kes and Ed exchanged glances. The Marshal's fears were well-founded.
"The hunt is growing fast. How long until we can't hide it anymore?"
After all, even with the scramblers, there were obvious signs of civilization that simply couldn't be hidden. There had even been a faint trickle of villagers from neighboring lands approaching the haunt and asking to be let in. How they had learned about its existence in the first place wasn't hard to guess. Not all the Barova survivors were Ed's minions. So far, they'd eluded the Inquisition's investigations, but the arrival of newcomers was a signal that information was leaking. Some nights, Ed couldn't sleep. One of these days, he'd wake to find out that the first team of heroes had found their way into the haunt. And once that happened, even if he defeated them, that'd only mean that the rest of the player base of Ivalis Online would make a beeline for his dungeon. He knew exactly how they would feel, in fact. Pride at being the first, and only, player to defeat a particularly troublesome boss, along with frustration when he couldn't seal the deal and another team finished the quest before he could return to claim revenge. If he had only known why those bosses didn't respawn. Levy's words danced in Ed's mind. He had the numbers to put up a fight. He knew things about the heroes that a normal dungeon lord didn't, and his grasp of Earth's technology and tactics was good enough that he could get it to work to his advantage if he used magic to plug those areas where he lacked expertise. But he'd still take losses, no matter what. People would die defending the dungeon, and bodies would pile up as high as those bonfires.
Unless I find the way to turn the tables.
The Wraith's Haunt. Dungeon Lord, Edward Wright. Drones, 55. Dominant Material, Cave Rock. Threat, 65. Local, 35 Haligis. Represents how aware the outside world is of the dungeon and how willing, able, or ready they are to do something about it. A 100 indicates imminent destruction. Offense, 3,000. A representation of the strength a dungeon's forces can muster during an attack, raid, or invasion, outside the dungeon itself. It represents the experience they would award, as a group, if they were defeated, but not absorbed. Defense, 4,500. The experience the population of a dungeon would award if they were to be defeated, but not absorbed, during the defense of said dungeon. It's multiplied by a percentage given by the dungeon's upgrades and defenses. Magic generated, 100. Measures the magic created by the sacred grounds that can be put to use in different endeavors or to power dungeon upgrades. Magic consumed, 35. Measures how much magic is consumed. Population. 82 humans, 12 combatants, 1 avian combatant, 324 batblins, 61 batblin combatants. Spider clusters. 1 empress, 5 queens, 23 princesses, 92 warriors. Unknown number of spiderlings. Unknown number of wounded. Areas. Living zones. Living quarters, storage, treasure chamber, caravan camp, mess hall. Military facilities. 3 batblin camps, 1 training facility, 5 spider dens, 1 Kuftar dojo, 1 prison. Research installations. 1 witchcraft laboratory. Upgraded. Library. Runemaker hall. 1 herbalist workshop. Upgraded. Medical facility. 1 taming stable. Sacred grounds. The seat. 1 light altar. 1 dark altar. Production. 1 forge. 1 brewery. 5 hell chicken breeding grounds. 1 kitchen. 1 mining facility. Underground farms. Stables. Defense. Heavy dust traps. Fake floors. Secret passages. Defensive spears. Batblin sentries. Spider sentries. Defensive potions and runes. Dungeon upgrades. Drone permanency. Scrambler towers. Ed dismissed the prompt with a thought. The increase in power from the spider's conquest had completely offset the dent that Nikolai made in the haunt's defenses months ago. When compared with the Batblin encampments, the Kuftar camp was a veritable fortress. Pointed tents made out of leather and cotton were organized in circular patterns with watchtowers guarding its perimeter. A few young warriors practiced combat drills in a sanded field. Handymen fixed broken tools under the shadow of their wooden sheds, and lumbermen teams delved into the forest under the protection of scouts armed with spears and long, fang-like daggers. Kuftar clan members marched at the edges of the camp, keeping their eyes on the woods despite the implied protection of Ed's creatures. Technically, the Kuftar cackle wasn't in Ed's employ. They were more like allies of the haunt. Only 10 of its members, grown from the original 5, had taken minionship with him, and 2 of those hurried to meet Ed's group as they passed alongside the camp.
"Greetings, Dungeon Lord,"
said Kaga as he pressed one arm to his chest in salutation.
"I take that the Spider Rebellion has been quelled?"
"Kaga? Yumiya?" Ed nodded at them. "Everything went as planned. Thanks for the insights on the warring dynamics of horned spiders."
"Anytime,"
said Yumiya. She was Kaga's second-in-command and the Haunt's foremost expert in monsters. And how to kill them. Both Kuftar were dressed in black armor made out of hardened spider chitin. They wore no shoes or gauntlets, since the shape of their hands was too paw-like for that kind of protection. At one point, Kaga had tried to add the spider's horn as an ornamental weapon into the armor design, but he'd kept poking himself with it.
How did the agility potion fare with the spiderlings?
Yumiya asked.
Well enough, Ed said. It did its job, but it didn't last as long as Andrina thought it would. It also only enhanced them by a couple of ranks instead of the usual 3 to 4.
Yumiya grunted thoughtfully.
A spiderling's metabolism is always on overdrive, so it's no surprise it burns through the potion. Their size plays a part, too.
Ed nodded. Potions didn't scale well with critters, as they were crafted for humans.
Well, we're onto something here. It'll be worth it if we keep experimenting.
Yumiya interpreted that as an order and crossed her right arm across her chest.
I'll do as you ask, Dungeon Lord. But it may be quicker if you allow us to experiment on the spiderlings directly.
Let's keep our mad science as friendly as we can, shall we?
Ed grinned at her. While they talked, Kaga had approached the Hell Chicken mounts and was examining Kes's neckbreaker with an inquisitive eye. The Hell Chicken had eye blinders in addition to the straps on its beaks, and the claws on its legs and wings had been sheathed with wool and leather.
How did the mounts fare?
Kaga asked Kes, keeping a prudent distance from Neckbreaker's beak.
Well, they behaved more or less,
Kes said.
At least this dung for brains didn't eat any of the fingers I've left.
She tapped at Neckbreaker's feathers.
You managed to reduce their aggression, Kaga, but I'd say not enough for actual combat. There's no way they wouldn't turn on us the instant we took the straps away. And they lack the temperament anyway. If one of our riders was wounded, not only would his mount turn against him, but all the others would as well.
The group stared at the Hell Chickens in silence. One of the advantages of being elite monster hunters was that Kaga and his team knew how to tame wild beasts, and they'd been working on the Hell Chickens, to some measure of success. The Kuftar named each beast and were trying their best to transform them into war mounts. If they succeeded, the Haunt would have a great advantage over other dungeons. War horses were rare and expensive, but Hell Chickens were faster and far more murderous counterparts that were also very easy to grow. It was risky, but with the heroes trailing the borders of Hoya, the Haunt needed all the advantages it could get.
They're less aggressive when well fed,
Kaga mused.
But they'll still pounce on anyone the second they sense any weakness. I've never seen anything like it. To be honest, at this point, taming these magnificent creatures is a personal mission of mine. If I could get the clan to raise a couple hundred of them...
He lowered his ears, lost in thought, probably thinking of bloodshed and warfare.
Ah, who knows what could happen?
He added wistfully.
To be honest, Ed said, I like the new version better.
A month ago, Levy had managed to fix St. Clair and Tillman's stupendous Hell Chicken farm. The new kit had turned out smaller Hell Chickens, which were gray and lacked the aggression of their counterparts. But Ed had kept the existing design, as well as the farms already in place, because a population of murderous, easy-to-grow beasts could come in handy. A few hours after adding Levy's design to the Haunt, he had received a letter from St. Clair and Tillman testily proclaiming that tampering with their devices voided the warranty.
They're good climbers,
Alder added, probably because he felt that Kes was being too harsh on her assessment. He patted his mount, Blood Fiend, who twisted its neck to throw Alder a murderous glance, which the bard ignored.
Actually, that's true,
Kes said, then shrugged.
But I honestly don't see how that helps us. Not counting Scar. We can't teach these assholes anything, and we can't trust them.
Levy shook her head and dismounted. She stood right next to her mount, Scar, at a distance that would have prompted an attack from any other Hell Chicken. Scar merely pretended she wasn't there.
You only need to figure them out, is all. If they sense any weakness, they'll pounce. But they won't risk defying someone stronger than them. So? Just don't have any weaknesses.
Scar kept its crimson eyes fixated away from Levy. It took its name from the long line of cracked and burnt tissue that crossed its beak side to side. Since its first encounter with Levy, Scar had been the only one of its species to show a willingness to listen during taming, but only to the witch. It seemed, to Ed, that they had reached a kind of murderous understanding.
"Or be crazy enough that the damn shit's by your bluff,"
Kes muttered. They all dismounted, and Kaga waved a group of young Kuffdars to take over the reins of the obsidian mounts. The Kuffdar tamers dragged them toward the stables next to the Cackles' camp, bribing the chickens with bloody steaks and the netherworld fungi that was the other half of their diet.
"Keep trying, so long as it's safe," Ed told the monster hunter. "They're too valuable not to. Maybe there's a way to fix the aggression problem, though. Perhaps we can alter St. Clair's tranquility potion somewhat."
"Maybe,"
Kaga said. Potions were outside his area of expertise. He was a user, not a crafter.
"But it has to be a change that doesn't take away their killer instinct. A fine line to tread, I'd say."
After the Kuffdar had taken their leave, Ed and the others strolled past the clan camp, and the jagged outcrop under which the haunt's dungeon was built came into sight. The boulders were shaped like broken edges, rising defiantly up to the evening sky. Past them grew a sea of mountaintops, half clouded by mist and snow, hiding the sea from view and casting the countryside in its shadow. The view dwarfed even Hoya, and it was Ed's constant reminder that, no matter how larger the haunt grew, it was nothing but a tiny dot in a world that hadn't been crafted for human-sized creatures. Those mountains in the distance were the true owners of the world, slumbering titans that cared nothing for the games of the light and the dark. The marketplace stood right under the skirt of the outcrop. It was tiny by all measures of size, both human and geological. The terrain was naked ground flattened by the daily stomping of dozens of feet, with several refurbished tents with straw roofs standing around the road that connected the dungeon to the Kuffdar camps. About a dozen villagers lounged inside the tents or walked around, despite the late hour. Hjorche's wife, Ivona, was in the middle of a heated discussion with a middle-aged man named Brine, who wore a black eye patch emblazoned with a silver laser shark. By the looks of it, Brine wanted to trade Ivona a small roll of blue cotton fabric in exchange for a pair of shears with brass handles, but she was out-haggling him with so much passion that it was a hair-breadth away from coming to blows. When contrasted to the mountains above, the marketplace was tiny and inconsequential. But to Ed, who knew its history, it meant much more. At first, the tents had been a temporary camp built to house the survivors of the attack on Barova. The villagers had been forceful guests of the haunt, prisoners in all but name, and thought of Ed and his minions as tyrants. That had all changed after Nikolai and his forces had stormed the haunt and unleashed an undead abomination that had attempted to drain the life out of its inhabitants. Defeating Nikolai had almost cost Ed his life and the lives of his friends, but afterward, the villagers' hatred had evaporated, despite the deaths of several men and women during the fight. Now, most of them lived inside the dungeon where Ed could best protect them, but they still preferred to spend time outside. Day-to-day life in Ivalis was dictated by sunlight, after all. Brine sighed loudly and added two packs of waxed hemp to his pile, thus finally getting Ivona to accept the trade. A few of the villagers caught sight of Ed's party and waved at them, some of them bending their knees slightly or crossing their hand over their chest in the Kuffdar's way. Ed returned the wave awkwardly, wishing people would stop treating him like some kind of royal figure. It set a bad precedent, because a part of him liked it. That part of himself was the reason that the dark god Murmur had chosen him to become a dungeon lord in the first place, despite Ed's refusal to join his ranks. Murmur apparently hoped that, in the end, the allure of power would become too great as the corruption grew too entrenched to resist. Humans, to the Hungry One, were but the instrument with which he proved his philosophy. Even the most virtuous man in the world would fall if Murmur offered a deal he couldn't resist. Ed disagreed, but even he had to admit that some days were harder than others. And he was far from the most virtuous man in the world.
Dungeon Lord!
Brian called, hurrying to meet Ed.
Marshal Kessa, Masters Lavina and Alder, I take that we triumphed against the rebellious spider scum?
Obviously,
said Levy with a prideful grin.
What else did you expect? Victory was inevitable with me leading the charge.
Brian shot her a nervous smile.
Of course, Master Lavina, of course. Didn't mean to imply otherwise.
Ed rolled his eyes. Most of the villagers were deathly afraid of Levy because she spent a large portion of her time trying to raise the spirits of the dead to serve her. It was an image that the witch was happy to indulge.
It's like she's trying to get burned at the stake.
Levy, you helped just as much as I did.
Alder began, but the witch pretended he was part of the scenery.
Spread the word,
she told Brine.
Tell everyone of our victory. Celebrations are in order.
Kess shot Ed a glance.
Are they?
He shrugged.
Maybe they are. Victories should be celebrated.
One never knew when they'd have to mourn defeats. On the other hand, he barely had time to sit down and relax these days. How could he, with the threat of heroes looming over his haunt like a scythe?
But you'll have to toast in my absence, because I'm changing clothes and heading for Undercity. Oscor and I are meeting with Karmic and the Guild.
I'll go with you,
Kess said. Ed shook his head. If he let her, Kess would work day and night until she collapsed from exhaustion.
Take a breather, Kess. I'll ask Laurel to lend me her royal guard.
Ah, a feast,
said Alder, pretending not to have heard Ed.
A bard's natural environment. What a perfect time to share my new verses with an eager public.
He smiled broadly. A captive audience was to him what baby seals were to a shark.
Sorry, Ed told him. You know I need you in Undercity with me.
Alder looked crestfallen.
We're still pretending I'm the one calling the shots? I swear, Ed. Everyone there already suspects who you are.
Alder, you should know having a suspicion that you can ignore is very different than someone forcing you to confront it,
Levy said petulantly. She picked at her fingernails and grinned.
Don't worry. I'll have the Batblins toast in your honor.
Oh, great. That makes it so much better,
Alder said sadly. But he made no more complaints.
Thank you, my lord,
Brian told Ed.
Your cruelness is most gracious. But, with all due respect, we refuse to celebrate without you alongside us. We'll wait until you return, and then we'll feast. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a celebration at all.
That's very nice of you to say, Brian.
Thank you, Ed said. Behind him, he could sense Alder trying to withhold a cheer.
I'll try to deal with these matters quickly and be back in a couple days at the most.
One more thing, my lord, with your permission,
Brian said, holding his hat in front of him.
Are there any news about the heroes?
Brian looked over his shoulder and bent his fingers in the shape of a ward against ill fortune.
Word's been spreading,
he said, lowering his voice to a whisper.
Other dungeons between Galtia and Undercity have been attacked. Bandits and renegade Kuftar live in most of them. But my cousin says that another dungeon lord fell recently. He says the heroes are coming closer by the day.
I see, Ed said.
He exchanged glances with his friends. Alder's smile had left his face, and Levy was pale. They both knew firsthand the destructive capability of the inhuman creatures that the militant church used as their anti-dungeon lord weapon.
Don't worry, Brian. We aren't like other dungeons. When they come, we'll be ready.
Brian faked a confident smile.
The light shall rue the day it defied the haunt.
Just don't let our friendly local priest hear that, or we'll never survive the sermon.
Levy urged the villager as they left him behind. Then she asked,
So, what's our plan? We have a plan, right?
Oh, we do, Ed said, smiling broadly. Do you know what a railroad is, Levy?
No.
The witch raised her eyebrows and glanced at the others, who shrugged as well.
Don't worry. You will.
The entrance to the dungeon was disguised by illusions of solid rock. It led to a tunnel lit by magical torches containing glowing crystals instead of flame, which bathed the rock in soft purples and pinks. Rows of crude stone statues shaped like winged gargoyles twice the size of Ed lined each side. Their eyes were engraved diamonds, which shone under the torchlight and gave them a lifelike aura, as if they were following the Dungeon Lord as he went. The gargoyles were another creation of his drones, as evidenced by the fact that his minions had had to add a woolen loincloth to every one. So far, the gargoyles were just statues, but Ed had known as soon as he had seen them that he'd animate them as soon as he found out the appropriate spell. If there wasn't one, he'd create it from scratch.
I only hope we can glue those loincloths in place.
He thought of Ryan, his former boss at Laser Shark, and imagined the expression he'd make if a naked gargoyle rushed at his character in the middle of a raid.
Maybe my drones are onto something.
There's the mad grinning again,
Kes warned him. They left the tunnel to arrive at the dungeon's main hall. Once, it had been a partially collapsed cave hiding a few rotting crates of provisions that Dungeon Lord Kale Arpadel had chosen to keep away from his main dungeon. One could barely find that cave now. The jagged roof had been replaced by a polished dome built out of stone slabs covered with obsidian plating. Diamonds encrusted in the obsidian imitated Ivalian constellations. A silver chandelier hung from the dome's apex, with long arms surrounding its body and giving it a spherical shape meant to represent Ivalis's most famous moon, Kamkana. Regenerating candles burned at the upper end of each of the eight arms, and the black wax rained down to the marble floor, where it flowed through canals carved as the figure of a mighty laser shark. Much to Ed's dismay. Braziers burned in brass stands along the circular walls, each shaped like an elongated skeletal arm. Tapestries covered the walls. Most of them showed, in the drone's crude needlework, the history of the dungeon since its creation. In one, Ed and Levy faced the Batblin band back when Ed had first arrived in Ivalis, with Alder cowering behind the duo. In another, Spider Queen Amphoris collapsed as the ground gave way under her and Ed charged her with his flaming sword. A different scene showed Inquisitor Gallio and Ed standing at opposite sides of the broken body of the Mind Brood. Farther along was the scene of a huge bonfire, with a humanoid figure writhing among the flames. Ed wasn't much of a fan of those tapestries. His favorites were the ones the artisans of Barova were slowly adding to the bunch. They were normal pieces of art. The kind, he guessed, that might be found in the home of any Staravosi individual that could afford it. Flowers, coats of arms of famous kings, the ashen face of a mythical vampire, even a depiction of Oinus, god of commerce, handing a golden coin from the heavens down onto a starving crowd below. The drone's artwork and the villagers' homey decorations didn't mesh well at all. But Ed found it fitting. Life was built upon contrasts. Even when they didn't pair well together, a home in perfect harmony was one where no one lived. The dungeon was very far from perfect harmony. Brewer Batblins pushed small carts carrying beer barrels, trying to move through the same tunnels that the kitchen Batblins were using to haul food. Both teams wanted to enter the tunnel first, and neither were willing to yield. While Ed watched, one of them threw a pie, and then an all-out brawl started. Nearby research Batblins, Levy's assistants, hurried away from the combat area and whispered among themselves in a way vaguely reminiscent of the witch. Villagers around the laser shark engravings gossiped between themselves after a day of hard work. They were carpenters, traders and merchants, leather workers, candle makers, tailors, cobblers, and more. Ed knew most of their faces and some of their names. A few had been with the haunt since Barova, and others had arrived on their own, heeding the grapevine rumors of the haunt's prosperity that seeded the neighboring villages. They had brought their trades with them as well as their families. A group of elite janitor Batblins saw the battle between brewer and kitchen and hefted their mops and crowd control sticks and dove valiantly into combat, their child-sized gambeson tunics deflecting beer mugs and fruitcake projectiles. The villagers began taking bets. So far, the ferocious kitchen Batblins were winning by circling their service carts and bunkering behind them, but the grizzled janitors were storming the defenses, even after their leader had been knocked out by a flying salsa jar. Ed smiled, basking in the cacophony of cursing and thrown cutlery. The air smelled of lavender and thyme and burning incense. He took a moment to enjoy the warmth flowing up from the floor, which came from the furnace down below.
Ah, home, at least, he thought happily.
Then he rained drones all over the brawl. Chapter 4 Soul Survivor. High above the vaulted domes of Uraz's dungeon, a Batblin hung with most of his body glued to the center of a spider web. His weight pulled the fine silver lines taut. Instead of struggling, though, he remained as stiff as he could. An involuntary twitch from his fingertips would send waves of vibrations spreading through the strands like water filling up a labyrinth. Many of his kind had found horrifying deaths when walking through a dark forest alone and wandering into the sticky trap of a horned spider eager to sink its claws into soft, delicious Batblin flesh. And the horned spider that glanced at this lone Batblin from her vantage point on the ceiling was a princess, a full station above the lowly warriors that preyed on his kind. To most Batblins, it would have been a nightmarish situation. But Kleck Adventurer's Bane wasn't like most Batblins. He paid no attention to the lurking mass of the horned princess. His eyes were closed, and his long, pointed ears were tense with focus.
Don't move!
Tulip hissed, her mandibles clicking with irritation.
You must remain still, or the vibrations will scramble and become unreadable.
More unreadable, you mean?
Kleck whispered, barely moving his lips.
It's a mess down below, and I can barely understand what's going on.
There's not much to understand,
Tulip said darkly.
It's a massacre, and if we don't escape soon, we'll be next.
Don't worry, Tulip. They can't see us.
Kleck assured her. Similar to him, she wasn't like most horned spiders. Tulip was small for a princess, exchanging brawn for speed and a healthy dose of common sense that some may call cowardice. To Kleck, they were the same thing. Tulip's concerns were well-founded. If the Inquisitors roaming Uraz's dungeon looked up, there was a chance their gazes may pierce the shadowy corner that Kleck and Tulip occupied. If that happened, Kleck had no doubt about the outcome. His own common sense told him he was insane, risking himself like this on the off chance of finding something that Lord Ed could use against the heroes who, day by day, neared the Haunt's territories. He tightened his jaw, willing himself to remain calm. A racing heart could be enough to set off the vibrations.
This should be a job for a spiderling,
Tulip complained after a moment of silence.
Unlike us, they're expendable.
No one is expendable,
Kleck chided her, trying to keep the edge out of his voice.
Spiderlings ain't clever. That's why Lord Ed entrusted this quest to us. We cannot fail him.
He took another deep breath and focused on his echolocation talent, which allowed him to sense the world around him using sound bouncing off surfaces. It was an activated talent with a small energy expenditure. Normally, using it required no concentration at all. But this wasn't a normal circumstance.
Now be quiet. They're moving already.
Damn snack, thinking he can preach to me.
Tulip mouthed to herself, yet loud enough for Kleck to hear.
Shh,
he urged her. Tulip shut up, leaving Kleck's whole attention on the vibrations coming from the spider web. He listened, moving his ears around as he tried to build a mental map of the surrounding chambers. There were about 2 dozen humanoids in the rooms below. 6 of them were armored, their every step clanking loudly and making distinct vibrations that Kleck quickly learned to distinguish. Inquisitors. They paced through stone corridors and tunnels and guarded the rest of the group as they stripped the dungeon and its former inhabitants of anything of value. Metal rang against metal as trinkets, weapons, armor, and other assorted loot was thrown into carts and wheeled out of the dungeon to the surface, away from Kleck's range of hearing. Dungeon Lord Uraz had traveled to Sturevos with a small fortune. Lord Edward's spiderlings had told him that Uraz had built 3 other dungeons before this one, all of them annihilated by the same group of heroes. Uraz probably would have kept going for a while before running out of resources, but the heroes had caught him before he'd added an escape route to this dungeon. Kleck shook his head. Had Uraz been a Batblin, he would have known to never lift a finger without at least 3 different escape plans. Uraz's demise was both a blessing and a curse for the Haunt. His presence near Hoya had drawn several groups of heroes away from Galtia, where most of them stripped the swamps of werewolf clans and searched the frozen mountaintops for the surviving vampire nobility of Sterevos. With Uraz gone, the heroes would be starving for action. If they didn't find it soon, they might return to Galtia. But in the meantime, their presence was a danger to everyone not under the protection of Haligis and its militant church. Lord Edward's plan was to study the heroes and the Inquisitors from afar until he could figure out the way they worked, then hopefully uncover the way to defeat them.
Who created the heroes? How do they work? And can we make our own?
These had only been a few of the questions Lord Edward asked aloud during countless nights pacing in the war room. He insisted that the heroes didn't fit the world of Ivalice as he, or anyone else, understood it. They were unnatural, artificial, made in that specific way for a specific reason.
If we can find out why, we can use it against them, he said. The first thing we must do to defeat a powerful enemy is to know the rules they follow. Find their limits, then exploit them.
Kleck wasn't a powerful warrior like Marshal Kess or Monster Hunter Kaga. Batblins were low on the food chain of a dungeon's minions, usually little more than arrow fodder. Expendable, just like spiderlings. But Lord Edward didn't see the world that way. He had given them a warm, safe home to hole up in winter and found them a place in the dungeon's hierarchy. Batblins were the Haunt's backbone. Messengers, cooks, and brewers. They assisted Andrina in potion-making and helped Yorche work his forge. Most of the elite janitorial squad came from their ranks. The Batblins of the Haunt were very different from what they'd been while surviving the unforgiving life of the forest, being chased by humans, and spiders, and wolves alike. Kleck himself differed greatly from the terrified Batblin he'd been before the Haunt. He was willing to do anything to avoid returning to those times. The spiderweb registered the approaching footsteps of a nearby Inquisitor. Despite being unable to distinguish the man's features, Kleck found the Inquisitor familiar, in the way a hound may recognize the mailman by their smell. Kleck held his breathing. Below, voices took the shape of waves as they crashed against the hard stone surface around them. Instead of causing the waves to break and dissipate, the stone carried them, vibrating in a tiny way that would have been impossible to sense by normal human, or Batblin, senses. Tulip's web, connected to the stone, picked up the vibrations and transmitted them to Kleck. Using his echolocation to translate the garbled mess of information that the stone picked up was an interpretation of the talent that strained the limits of objectivity's patience. And even then, Kleck had to use all his focus to filter the vibrations of that conversation out from all the other background noise that came to him at the same time. It was like putting his head down a confluence and guessing which water came from which river by drinking as fast as possible. Eminence. Survivor. Passageway. Rats scurrying through holes in the walls. People arguing. The clank of metal. Found? Someone taking a piss in an isolated corridor. A sneeze. The rattle of a wheelbarrow. Coffin inside. Dark magic. The Inquisitor and his interloper headed down a damp tunnel where several other Inquisitors and their helpers surrounded a hollow box that rested above a raised marble dais. Kleck strained to follow the conversation, but he was reaching the limits at which he could make sense of the vibrations. The other Inquisitors paced around the dais. An angry buzzing traveled through the web. Kleck had heard it before, in the Haunt's laboratory, where Levy worked her magic. Uraz's right hand. The vampire. The word captured Kleck's interest. He redoubled his efforts. Destroy it? There was a pause while the leader considered his options. No, he said. Execution. Constantina. Rebels must see. Kleck furrowed his brow. A pearl of sweat traveled down his nose and disrupted his mental picture. When he found the correct vibrations again, the familiar Inquisitor was ordering everyone around.
He didn't seem disturbed. Someone brought a long chain and waited until the magic around the dais evaporated. Then they chained the box. A coffin, Kleck thought. He heard the grunts and the strain as six people lowered the coffin down and heaved it on their shoulders. They carried it out, with the Inquisitors following.